This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There are three Democrats seeking the party's nomination for lieutenant governor. This week on Vermont Edition, we're talking to the candidates about the key issues in their race. And our series concludes today with Chittenden Senator David Zuckerman. Senator Zuckerman served 14 years in the House. He's been elected to two terms in the Vermont Senate. He's with us today. Great to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you have a comment or a question for Senator Zuckerman in the race for lieutenant governor. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's start off with this situation in the news today, these tragic shootings in Dallas, culminating a week of violence. You addressed it in an email today. You said, "I woke this morning deeply saddened, confused, and frustrated and angry at the continuation of unnecessary violence and loss of life that has been all over the news this week and for too long. Like many of you, I am reflecting on my role and how I can best combat racial, economic, and judicial injustice." What do you think needs to be done?
Well, certainly, I think many leaders across the country have done a good job of having us all pause and feel and experience the real pain, real frustration, real anger that's out there, but also pause, importantly, not to then react with further such actions. I think it's very important and responsible and reasonable to gather and have both vigils and call them protests if you want, or rallies for justice that we need to be addressing. But we all obviously have to work together to remain calm in respect to how we treat each other and work to move forward in a positive way in our culture and in our society. You know, we have plenty of problems right here in Vermont. You know, we've got data from reports that we've been working finally to accumulate data in Vermont with respect to the disproportionate number of people of color who are incarcerated in Vermont, the rates that people of color, Hispanic, Black, Latino, who are disproportionately pulled over and or their vehicles searched. And yet the statistics show that there's no justifiable reason for that. The rates of things that people find, that law enforcement finds in their car, whether it be drugs or others, is no different for people of color than it is white. And yet we still have a disproportionate rate of people of color getting pulled over. So we have to gather together, have the discussions, and really address what policy changes can happen. And really, in many respects, it's incumbent upon those in power, whether it be political leaders, law enforcement leaders, to make sure that those in power take responsibility for the first steps towards reaching out to the communities of color and bring them into the conversation, and not just talk at people, but actually hear what's happening and learn from it and change our policies. Because it's always incumbent on the folks in power to make the adjustments when there's injustices such as this happening.
We did get this email from Charlotte, who wrote, "I believe change will only come when we as a community and as a country see the killings of people of any race or religion as a threat to us all. It's important to focus on the fact that people of color are being terrorized and killed. What can Vermont do to lead the way towards anti-racist action, especially since we have so many challenges in this area, being historically such a very white community?"
Well, there's no doubt that more needs to be done. Some of these reports show that some, for instance, state police barracks in Vermont have higher rates of pulling over people of color compared to others. So I think we need to analyze why that's happening and likely include more training for our law enforcement in terms of what are our sort of inherent biases. You know, we can theoretically, all of us have to examine ourselves and how do we react when we see a person of color when you're walking down the street, or a person with long hair, or a person with any stereotypical characteristic, and say, wait a minute, am I stereotyping that person based on some characteristic that they have. So I think it's, not just law enforcement, but all of us have to look at our inherent biases and really evaluate ourselves before we start telling other people what they need to do. And that's part of what we need to do moving forward.
Today on the program, our guest is Chittenden Senator David Zuckerman. He is running in the Democratic primary for Lieutenant Governor. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. We're going to be talking about property taxes and health care and other issues. Perhaps you have some thoughts. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Now, in the Senate, members serve on two important committees. In your case, you're the vice chair of the Agriculture Committee. You're also a member of the Senate Education Committee. Now, look at the work of the lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor serves as the presiding officer of the Senate. The lieutenant governor helps appoint members to committees at the very start of the session, and they vote in cases of a tie vote in the Senate. But that's pretty much it. So some of our listeners might be wondering, why would you want to move from a position that determines important policy questions to a job that has very little defined authority?
Well, that's a fair question. And I suppose probably all three of us running for office can get that same question, from policymaking to sort of guiding the broader sentiment of the Senate and or the state. But when you look back at my 18 years of work between the House and Senate, and back to what first got me involved in politics, which was back in 1992 as a cynical young person, I wasn't interested in the political process at all. I was much more an activist on the University of Vermont campus, trying to make environmental changes, social justice changes. And I saw this guy running for Congress that obviously we're all extraordinarily familiar with these days, Bernie Sanders. And I said, wow, there's someone who states his views very clearly, guides in a much broader concept of where do we want to go with economic justice, environmental justice, social policy justice, to make a more fair and just society for all citizens. And I realized, as a political leader, you can do that in the political arena. That was shocking to me. And so I was very excited and started volunteering for him, and I met many others who got involved in the political process. And what I did when I first started then running a few years later, being asked to run by some local folks in Burlington, I realized that so much of what we can do in the political arena is done with people throughout the state becoming more engaged in the process. And we've heard Bernie talking about this for the last year as well. And when you look at the issues I've worked on over time, marriage equality, when I was the lead sponsor for many years, end-of-life choices, I was the lead sponsor for many years, GMO labeling, which I brought up maybe one of the first in the country around genetic engineering, those bills didn't ultimately become law via the internal dynamics of the political process in Montpelier. They became law because the people around the state were engaged in the process. And for me, moving into the office of lieutenant governor will actually afford me a greater opportunity to do that on a much larger scale, bring more people into the process. You've got time in the morning as lieutenant governor and time in the afternoon on either side of the floor session when you're technically moderating the Senate, where you can invite people into the state house, engage them in the process, work with them to push their legislators to move forward on big policy. And so I think there's a real opportunity on health care reform, raising the minimum wage, affordable housing, rural economic development, climate change, where being a leader and bringing people into the process is a real fit for me.
Let's talk about property taxes. Right now, about two-thirds of all homeowners in Vermont pay their property taxes based on their income, not the value of their house, a program known as income sensitivity. It's available to people with household incomes of less than roughly $100,000 a year. Do you think the state should shift to a system where all homeowners pay based on their income, basically taking that burden completely off of the property tax?
Well, actually, that's a bill and idea that Senator Polina here in Washington County and Representative Pearson from Burlington introduced in their respective chambers. And the new version of that idea, which has been out for a while, really looks like it's got some great potential. And I do think we should do that, although it's still a hybrid system. And the reason that it's really important to have it based on income for everybody is about fairness. Currently, the 70% of us that are, $100,000 or less paying based on income pay between about 2.5% and 3% of our income towards our education system. wealthier people, over that 100,000, it drops off to 2 and 1.5 and even 0.5% when you get up into the $500,000 to $1 million annual income taxpayers. If we all pay based on income, we're all feeling the pain proportionally to our income, and it would actually help those of us on the lower end of the economic spectrum, while certainly bringing a few more resources in from the top end. The main argument against that that people have brought up is that incomes are much more volatile than property values. But if the two are still interconnected, so that if it's still based on your property value and then everybody pays based on income, if all of our incomes change, then there will still be an adjustment, and it might be a slightly higher income rate for a couple of years, just like when our property values went down, the rate went up, but the actual dollars remain stable. So I think there's a real opportunity to have it based on income, but stay stable as well.
Let's go to our listeners and talk to James in Middlebury. Hey, James, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Yeah. As Senator Zuckerman knows, the problem in the lake is about 60 years old, and it doesn't really show any signs of improving anytime soon. He should be in a particularly good position if he becomes lieutenant governor to realize that secretaries of agriculture in the state of Vermont have always been chosen for their sympathy with the conventional dairy industry, and the conventional dairy industry, of course, is the proximate cause of the problem. The chairs of Senate agriculture and House agriculture are similarly selected for that same characteristic. I'm wondering if he becomes the lieutenant governor, what will he do to change that heritage, specifically that the Secretary of Agriculture needs to be take a different approach?
Well, thank you, James. And we have talked about this before. I appreciate your call. You know, the situation in agriculture is a very tricky one. I got a comment from someone from Burlington the other day who also said to me, well, you know, because you're in agriculture, you're going to take it soft on the farmers. And I responded that, frankly, as vice chair of agriculture in the Senate, I did help work on our water quality bill. And I can guarantee you that there's many farmers out there, particularly smaller farmers, conventional and otherwise, who are feeling like the new water quality bill is quite a squeeze. Now, I know that plenty of advocates also feel like it's not enough and not quick enough. The bill we tried to pass in Senate Ag actually would have had more resources to help match and draw down federal dollars, because the reality is many of these farmers do want to be better stewards of the land. But when they're getting $13.50 for their milk, which is about the price right now, I'm probably off by a little bit, they are scrapping for pennies everywhere they can. And that doesn't mean they should have license to pollute, but it also means it's pretty hard to invest in a $50 or $100 or $200,000 system to reduce that pollution. So to me, you know, it really comes down to a fundamental partly of what are we all ready to pay for our food, as well as how can we ask farmers to do more? Because ultimately, if farmers are struggling to pay their bills, they're not going to be able to do everything they can and would like to do to create cleaner waterways. And we did learn in the legislature this year about 40% of the pollution is farming, about 40% is transportation and highways and runoff from highways, and I think about 20% is urban sewage scenarios. And so, you know, we had a discussion in the State House, and it was all in. You know, everybody's got to get in to help solve the problems. But, you know, our food system is one that's shifting in the state. We have a thriving, growing, diversified agriculture sector, and I'd actually really like to see us continue to expand that, because it's in those arenas where people are getting paid what they deserve for their work, where then they can also treat the land in a better way. And so it's part of a bigger discussion.
We just got this email in from David in Callis, who would like to know, what are your views regarding the natural gas pipeline in Addison County, and how does this relate to your feelings regarding climate change?
Well, I appreciate that. I actually signed on to a letter opposing the pipeline. You know, I see the effects of climate change as we all do, from Hurricane Irene, which obviously was devastating to many in Vermont, particularly low-income people who lived in trailer homes near the rivers, but also others as well. But the impacts were huge, both personally and then broader scale for our culture and our infrastructure. And we have to stop building infrastructure that promotes the use of carbon-based fuels. Natural gas is better than coal, no doubt about it. But at this point, in the scenarios we're seeing with climate change, the lesser of evils is really still a great problem for the future of, you know, my 10-year-old. Many people out there have children. And I also was looking at the cost factor on that. And all ratepayers throughout the northern part of the state who currently have gas into their homes or to their businesses are also going to pay higher rates. That's going to affect seniors and their bills, working class families and their bills. And I would rather see us invest that kind of money in weatherization, solar power on roofs, and other ways to change the energy system in our state.
Would you support a carbon tax in Vermont?
You know, we have to have the discussion of a carbon-based culture, which is what we have right now. And there's no doubt, I think that bill brought a very good conversation to the table. How do we make sure that low-income people and rural people aren't disproportionately affected by that? You know, if you live in Burlington or somewhere where there's a bus system and you can pay to ride a bus to work, then a carbon tax isn't going to affect you very much. But if you live in a rural area where you're driving 40 miles to get to work every day, we can't create a system that disproportionately affects those folks. So as long as there's a carbon tax that greatly returns those resources, and I think many aspects of the bill did that, by lowering sales taxes for everyone, by investing in weatherization, but we should focus it in those rural areas first to make sure their other bills go down if their carbon bills are going to go up. You know, it's a discussion we have to have because we've got to shift the dynamics of our energy use.
Today on the program, our guest is Chittenden Senator David Zuckerman. He's seeking the Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about health care. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Chittenden Senator David Zuckerman, seeking the Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk about health care. If I remember correctly, in the past, you've been a supporter of a publicly financed single-payer system. Governor Shumlin came to the conclusion several years ago that it would take a significant payroll tax to be imposed on individuals and businesses to pay for this system, and so he chose not to pursue that option. Was he wrong?
Well, I think we still need to continue the conversation because when I asked a number of business owners when I was running for the Senate 2 and 4 years ago, who were coming to me and saying, you know, there's no way we could afford a payroll tax in the 6, 8, 10 and maybe even 13% range that the governor eventually came to as the number. I said, do you know how much you're paying right now to cover your employees with the health benefits that you offer? And a number of them actually said, well, I haven't quite done that analysis yet. And one of the things that's really important to talk to any business owners is, if you're providing health care today, what is that percentage of your payroll? Because, again, that would disappear. And you've got to, we do have the boogeyman factor of, you know, this tax is going to go up. Well, a lot of us are paying pretty significant premiums. You know, right now I'm on Vermont Health Connect with my family. And if I look at that as a percentage of my income, it's up in the 10% range of our income goes towards the premium for Vermont Health Connect. And then on top of that, the out-of-pocket, which in my situation has been significant the last couple of years. My wife's been suffering from Lyme disease. And, you know, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars out-of-pocket. I guarantee you that as a percentage of income, if it was based on my income or my payroll, it would be a lower amount than what I've been paying. So when you really look at it and you step back, healthcare dollars are consuming so much of our economy. And if we could move towards a more efficient system, a one-payer or all-payer system, then we would cut out some of the costs in that system. And that's what's really choking our economy. We also have people who are staying in a job that they've got because it provides healthcare. Incredibly brilliant-minded individuals who are ready to go start out with a new idea, but they can't leave their job to start that new business and take the risk for 6 months or a year to see if they can get a new idea going. and be without health care. So I still would like to see us move towards a universal health care system. There are some great ideas happening around the legislature. The universal primary care legislation idea that we're studying, I think, has some real promise. Dinosaur 2.0 to expand that to older years is also a real potential. And so I'd like to see where those go in taking the various steps towards getting to a universal healthcare system.
You know, some people look at the very difficult rollout of Vermont Health Connect, and it's caused a lot of people to lose their confidence in the government's ability to get involved in healthcare. What do you say to those folks who say, you know, the experience of Vermont Health Connect shows this is a perfect reason why government should not be involved?
Well, I think that's a fair and reasonable critique and frustration, and that comes down to management. And obviously, we will have a new governor this year to manage our state government. And as someone who runs a farm, and I'm always looking for efficiencies and coaching my crew on ways to work their bodies less hard, because farming is really hard to do, and how it will be a faster and more efficient way to get the job done. You know, I can let people know certainly that my mind as a small business owner, agricultural entrepreneur, very much are about efficient and productive work. You know, it's interesting, when Schapp first became speaker a number of years ago, I said to him, you know, we've had a healthcare special committee, but now with ACA and other things are moving forward. Why not set up a government efficiency and accountability committee and draw in people from each of the different committees who have experience and start tackling one agency after another, you know, each one for a couple of years at a time, to really root out opportunities for efficiency and better productivity, and work with the state employees on how we can adjust how government works to make things better. He didn't do that, and that's okay. But to me, whoever is governor, it's really their leadership capacity that will lead to government's ability to do the job right. And I think we have that opportunity coming up.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Adrian in Burlington. Hey, Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Senator, I'm a young person. I'm planning on having children in the near future. I have some serious concerns about your belief that the science behind vaccines is disputed and your position on loosening vaccine requirements for school-age children. So I was wondering if you could explain your vote on that issue and your position on the vaccination of kids in our public schools.
I first want to address your comment of the science behind it and my questioning the science behind vaccines. That is actually not the reality for me. I recognize that vaccines have done tremendous good in our society and do help eliminate and many risks and reduce other risks. The discussion was really about whether or not government can sort of require you to inject ultimately any such chemicals into your body. And I do have a really high level of sacredness for our own bodies and controlling our bodies, which is partly also why I'm very strongly pro-choice for women. And so it gets into very touchy territory when government starts telling you what you have to do or what you can and can't do with your own body. And for me, very briefly, it also harkened back to a personal experience where my father was in medicine. There was a new technology that actually has since saved hundreds of thousands of lives, and it had to do with some radioactive isotopes that you put into a patient's system while you're operating on them so you could see where their blood vessels were. And when that technology was new, they didn't know that doctors should wear lead vests to protect themselves. And my father, along with a few other doctors in the field, died of stomach cancer, and I was 13. And so, you know, sometimes personal experiences can have a profound effect on your outlook on things. And so a scientific advancement that has saved hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lives also had, while very few, real collateral effects, and I happen to have been, unfortunately, experienced that. And so for me, particularly the families where an individual has three or four children, and that first child has a very severe reaction to a vaccine, I think they should have that choice with their second, third, or fourth child if they potentially have a genetic predisposition to react to whatever is in the vaccine, to have that choice. So it is nuanced, and that issue became very black and white in that day. But overall, the initial part of your question was the presumption that I don't trust the science. I do trust the science.
We just got this email from Brian in Middlebury who writes, Why are you running in the Democratic primary if you're not planning to run as a Democrat in the fall? Let me expand that out a little bit, because in the past you've run as a progressive and you've run as a fusion candidate, a progressive slash Democrat. You know, there's some members of the Democratic Party, and I should mention there are quite a few people who are running this year as fusion candidates, both for the Vermont Senate and the Vermont House. So there's some members of the Democratic Party who are not very happy with this development, and they say, hey, you've got your own primary. Why are you coming over into the Democratic Party primary?
Well, it's an interesting darned if you do, darned if you don't situation. Many, many people have argued that folks shouldn't run, quote, three-way races. And that it splits the vote and so forth and so on. And when I ran for the Chittenden County Senate, I reached out an olive branch and said, you know, I'm happy to run in the Democratic primary, work with Democrats. I have for all of the 14 years, also when I was a representative. In fact, the Democratic Speaker, Gay Symington, appointed me chair of agriculture when I was solely a progressive. So I think there's great evidence that I work well with people of all parties. And if you look at the major bills that I worked on and have passed, it's been with support of all party members. So, you know, we can get all wrapped up in partisan bickering and so forth. But I'm running in the Democratic primary to give voters the choice within the Democratic primary where it's more comfortable for many voters not to have to then in a general election pick between a three-way race where the debate is all about spoiler and not about issues. And as you mentioned, Bob, you know, I did this in the Democratic primary for Chittenden County Senate. The voters, Democratic voters, have elected me. I think most voters don't care that much about party labels. They want to know in general what you stand for and what issues you care about. And they elected me out of the county there, and I think statewide that method resonates for a lot of people. You know, Bernie, some would say then, well, why did Bernie run in the Democratic primary? Well, 86% of Vermont was more than happy to support Bernie. Shap, one of my opponents, supported Hillary in that scenario. Maybe that's because of the party, you know, importance. But to me, you know, Bernie is a great example of working within the system and also working to change the system. And so by running as both, I think that's what I'm trying to do. Run within the system where it's comfortable for people to engage, but also change it to where people can have more choices.
Today in the program, we're talking to Chittenden Senator David Zuckerman, who is seeking the Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor. Your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk about gun control. Do you support efforts to implement tougher gun control laws in Vermont? For instance, would you support background checks for all gun sales, including all private and family sales?
Well, when I ran for the Senate 4 years ago, and this was starting to be talked about and less broadly supported than I think it even is now, I made it clear that I support universal background checks. And you've gone into a little more detail there with private sales and between family members. You know, it's not that hard to set up a system where people go to a gun store and ask for a background check to be run. And yeah, maybe there's going to be a small fee for that. But I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And unfortunately, I do think it's important to do with family members as well. When you look at domestic assault, when you look at, unfortunately, other predation that happens, more often it's someone you know and sometimes even family members that do it, and you wouldn't have expected it. And so I think it's equally important between, you know, family members. It isn't that great a hurdle to make sure that folks who might have a record aren't possessing weapons that can hurt people.
Now, how about a ban on military-style assault weapons?
You know, that's a harder one to truly just lock down and say yes. And one of the reasons for that is there's no legal definition for what a military assault weapon is or a semi-automatic weapon is. And, you know, I'm learning more and more. I'm not a gun owner, and I've talked with a number of gun owners about how, you know, different guns come in with different pieces and parts, and you can buy a gun that isn't an assault weapon or a semi-automatic, and you change out a couple parts, and it is. And so, you know, to categorize it is part of the difficulty in drafting up language to do such things. You know, one of my employees is a hunter. We've talked about clip sizes and the limitation on clip sizes. I think that's an important piece of Vermont, and we need to make sure that applies across the board. And, you know, we should look at what some of these weapons can do and are they necessary for hunting and self-defense, et cetera, and look at whether or not that discussion can move forward with arms owners as well as people who are really concerned about the overabundance of weapons in our society.
We got this email that just came in from Rabia in Norwich, who wrote, "There's much talk by candidates about how difficult it is for people to live on the minimum wage, how it should be raised to $15 an hour. That's about $30,000 a year. No one is talking about how truly difficult it is for retired folks living on tiny Social Security checks, many receiving less than $15,000 a year. Do you have any ideas of how to increase income for these elderly retired folks?"
Well, I think it's interesting when you look at many retired folks, and this sounds like it was a woman's name who wrote that in. You know, women are paid less day to day in our society. And that means when they retire, their Social Security pay is also going to be lower. And so there's two different issues here. One is the systemic inequality of women not being paid equally. And that's something we have to address. And I was a supporter of language that would pay people equal pay for comparable work, because it's very easy legally to say equal pay for equal work. Well, you're not doing the exact same job, so you get paid a different amount. So that's part one, and that's towards working towards long-term change in the future, which often is my method of thinking. When you look at the bills I introduced, it wasn't something that was going to solve a problem overnight, but it was going to ultimately change the dynamic of our society and how people are treated economically or with justice. And secondly, for seniors, we have to look at making numerous things better for seniors. From should we tax Social Security earnings, which we're one of, I think, six states that still does tax that, as well as looking at other types of programs we afford that we have in the state towards keeping people in their homes, because as much as $15,000 isn't a lot of money, it's way too little money to pay for nursing care home or group living scenarios. So, you know, I don't have all the answers. I'm the first to admit that. But what we should do as someone in the lieutenant governor's role is bring more people into the process, look for the ideas from the people to bring into the process, and not just have it all be inside Montpelier sort of beltway talk.
Let's see if we can get a very quick call in from Naomi in Moncton. Hi, Naomi. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I know you already talked about the pipeline, but my concern is that we have, a utility commission with three members on it that are unelected, that are making decisions for the state in terms of energy that I think are poor decisions. And I'm wondering, is there a way to change that? And also, what is your position on the board?
So, the lieutenant governor actually neither creates or proposes laws, nor do we make the appointments that the governor makes to such boards and commissions. I do think it's important to have a board, and maybe it should be bigger and have more diverse viewpoints on it for what is, quote, the greater good or the common good. And that's really the underlying principle of what that board is about, because sometimes when we focus only on what's going to be good for one part of the state or one community, it doesn't take into account what's happening across the state. So I do think we need a public service board, but I certainly think it could be expanded and have more voices in it.
Well, the primary election is coming up in a little over 4 weeks on Tuesday, August 9th. Early voting has already started. Chittenden Senator David Zuckerman, many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, I appreciate it, Bob, and thank you, listeners. I hope I can earn your support out there anytime between now and the 9th. And please feel free to contact my campaign at Zuckerman4VT.com if you have further questions.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at the TV and radio ads that the five candidates for governor are now running. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In just over 4 weeks, Vermont will hold its primary election and determine who the major party candidates are going to be for a variety of statewide and local offices. There are three candidates seeking the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, and two candidates are seeking the Republican nomination. All of the candidates are now running TV or radio ads to support their campaigns. Well, what are the messages that these candidates are trying to convey to voters? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Neil Goswami, who is Bureau Chief at the Vermont Press Bureau. Neil, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Great to be here, Bob. Thank you.
Neil, all these candidates certainly have an eye towards the August 9th primary election with their ads, but early voting has already started. So are these candidates launching these ads at this time in part to try to influence some of these early voters?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's really three Democrats, two Republicans that are up on the airwaves now. Four out of the five are on TV. Phil Scott is on the radio. They have varying degrees of need out there right now. Some need to get their name out there and be better recognized. Others need to push specific policy ideas or proposals. So they're using these advertising spots as a way to reach those folks who are beginning to vote already a month away from the primary.
Now, of the three Democrats, Matt Dunne has been doing the most advertising so far. Dunne served in both the Vermont House and Senate. He was appointed as the head of AmeriCorps Vista in the late 1990s. Most recently, he's been the community affairs director at Google. Here's one of his ads.
Bernie Sanders has started something amazing, and I'm running for governor to make his vision a reality right here in Vermont. Let's start by banning corporate money in politics. Let's raise the minimum wage so no one working full time lives in poverty. And when it comes to healthcare, let's fix the website and get back on the path to universal healthcare. Together, we can do this.
Paid for by Matt Dunne for Vermont, Barbara Grimes, treasurer.
So, Neil, right at the outset, Dunne ties himself to the Bernie Sanders revolution. What do you think of this strategy?
Yeah, that's right. You know, that was the second of the two television ads he's got out. And in both of them, he's really tried to hang on to the coattails of Bernie Sanders. We know Bernie Sanders is wildly popular here in Vermont. He really cleaned up in the presidential primary a little while ago. He wins election after election here in Vermont with very wide margins. So I can see the appeal of candidates wanting to pick up that mantle and run with it. Although, you know, you have to also be your own candidate. And there is a risk of voters looking at candidates trying to tie themselves as Matt Dunne as just mimicking somebody else and not being their own person. So, you know, there's a risk reward here, and Matt Dunne is banking on there being a lot of reward.
Is this a key constituency group for the Democratic primary?
Yeah, I really think it is. You know, there's a lot of very progressive-minded Democrats here in Vermont. And the folks who will come out in the primary and vote are going to be probably more progressive than the general electorate. So tying yourself to some of these ideas like $15 minimum wage, you know, he talks about a path to universal health care, banning corporate contributions. These are all ideas that are likely to be very popular among Democratic primary voters.
Sue Minter is also seeking the Democratic nomination. Minter served in the Vermont House representing the town of Waterbury. She also served as transportation secretary in the Shulman administration, and she was the state's chief recovery officer after Tropical Storm Irene. Her experience during Irene is the focus of her first TV spot. Let's listen to it.
Vermont's worst disaster in a century. Destruction for miles. As Irene Recovery Officer, Sue Minter helped lead the rebuilding, with hundreds of miles of road repaired and thousands of homes restored.
She got us back on our feet, gave everybody hope that we would get through this together as a community. When I look at Vermont today and I see the challenges we're facing, Sue is exactly the kind of governor we can count on every day.
Paid for by Sue Minter for Vermont, Duncan McDougall, Treasurer.
So, Neil, the message there: she helped out during Irene. She can help Vermont in the future.
I think that's really the key message here. And, you know, Minter served as Secretary of Transportation, a very important role in Vermont government, but perhaps not one that most Vermonters are that familiar with. So sort of rolling out the things that she was able to accomplish as both Irene Recovery Czar and Secretary of Transportation, rebuilding roads, rebuilding houses after that devastating storm, that's all something that will probably appeal to voters. After Tropical Storm Irene, Governor Shumlin had very high approval numbers because of the response. If she can remind voters how the response went here in Vermont compared to some other states, that's going to be a bonus for her.
The third candidate in the Democratic primary contest is Peter Galbraith. He's a former state senator from Windham County, former ambassador to Croatia. This is the way that he's introducing himself to voters in his first TV spot.
I'm Peter Galbraith, fighting for the underdog, taking on the powerful. That's what I've done. As a senator, I made Vermont the first state to ban fracking. The special interest didn't like it. As governor, I'll stand up for our families, a $15 minimum wage, and free tuition at Vermont state colleges. And I'll pay for it by ending special interest tax breaks so they pay their fair share. Paid for by Galbraith for Vermont, not the special interest. Roger Albee, treasurer.
So, Neil, with the issues of special interest tax breaks, free college tuition, is Galbraith also trying to appeal to those Bernie Sanders supporters?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the platform is very, very similar to what Senator Sanders had on the national stage. Peter Galbraith has by far the most aggressive tuition plan, free college tuition at Vermont State Colleges for Vermont students who meet the admissions requirements. He talks about paying for that through closing special interest tax loopholes, $15 minimum wage, banning fracking. These are all things that Senator Sanders found success with and that Peter Galbraith is using to sort of portray himself as an outsider like Sanders. And, you know, he mentions fighting for the underdog. I think here in this three-person race, he is the underdog, and he's using those issues and those themes to help appeal to voters.
Now, over on the Republican side, we have two candidates. One of them, former businessman Bruce Lissman. His opponent is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Lissman has been running a fair number of TV ads, and many of them are critical of Scott's relationship with Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin. Here's the latest TV spot for Lissman.
I'm Bruce Lissman, and I am not the usual guy. And I don't do the usual things. Not like this guy. Phil Scott stood next to Peter Shumlin at a press conference for the failed health exchange. I wouldn't do that. Or when Phil went along with Shumlin's reckless budgets and called Shumlin fiscally prudent. I definitely wouldn't do that. What I will do is change the direction of Vermont. Now that would be unusual. Paid for by Lissman for Vermont.
Beverly Biello, treasurer.
So, Neil, what do you make of Lissman's approach and the strategy that he's using?
Well, you know, he's got the fun music and the fun sound effects, but he's trying to make a very serious point, or some might say accusation, in that Phil Scott is too close to Peter Shumlin and in the policies of the last 6 years. You know, this latest ad that Lissman is running follows very closely with a series of direct mail pieces that Lissman sent out, you know, that the Vermont Health Connect, single payer, all types of issues that Lissman seems to think Phil Scott was too close to the governor on.
As you said, Phil Scott is very popular. Is Lissman taking a risk here by criticizing Scott as much as he has?
You know, sure, it's a risk, but, you know, I think he's looking at probably polling numbers that are out there that the candidates have seen that shows that he's got a long way to go. And the only way to advance himself is to try and bring down Phil Scott's numbers a little bit. And so he's doing his best, and this is the approach that they've decided to take.
Now, Phil Scott is the one gubernatorial candidate who has not run any TV spots yet. He has released a radio spot. Let's listen to it.
Phil Scott shares his Vermont values.
Trust and integrity are very important. Vermonters are yearning for that again. They want to trust their government. We have a responsibility. Listening to people, listening to their concerns is half the battle because their frustration arises when they don't think anybody hears them. I firmly believe that we can't tax people anymore. There isn't that capacity. So we have to grow the economy.
Paid for by Phil Scott for Vermont. Glenn Wright, treasurer.
What's the message there from Phil Scott?
Well, this follows a theme that Phil Scott has really maintained throughout this campaign and previous campaigns. He likes pretty broad ideas, you know, dealing with affordability. Vermonters are, you know, overtaxed. He keeps his ideas and thoughts very broad. He likes to talk about Vermont values, which, you know, people identify with. I'm sure they've tested that and find it that it's very effective. But there are very few policy prescriptions in this. And this is, we should note, this is a radio ad. Phil Scott, you know, as mentioned, is not up on the television airwaves yet. And that's probably a sign that he's pretty confident in the lead he has over Bruce Lissman, and he's saving his war chest for a Democratic opponent after the primary.
So what do you think Bruce Lissman would have to do in the next 4 weeks to make this a really competitive race?
He's got to somehow find a way to bring Phil Scott's numbers down. You know, Phil Scott is very popular. His favorability ratings are always high. And, you know, that's I'm not sure how you do that without a full-on negative onslaught. And as we've seen in the past, that really doesn't reverberate well with Vermonters. So I'm not sure if there's a real pathway for Bruce Lissman to be able to bring Phil Scott's numbers down.
Neil Goswami is Bureau Chief for the Vermont Press Bureau. Neil, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is our program for today. Rutland has been in the thick of the debate over bringing Syrian refugees to Vermont. Mayor Christopher Lewis has strongly supported the move to have 100 of the refugees find a home in Rutland, but there's been opposition from a group called Rutland First. Monday, we'll hear both sides of that debate. Email your questions about it to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.